Good morning, this is Paul Sigrist for the National Park Service. Today is Tuesday, August 6th, 1991. We're here in Brooklyn with David Froelich, who came from Germany in 1939 when he was 11 years old. Good morning.
Good morning.
Could you please give me your full name, middle name included, right, if there is one, and your date of birth?
Please. David Froelich, no middle name. I was born on June 2nd, 1930. So 1928 in Würzburg, Germany, which is 44 kilometers north of my hometown, Bad Mergentheim. That's a health resort, a very famous health resort in southern Germany for internal diseases.
I'd like you to spell both towns, please.
All right, that's B-A-D hyphen M-E-R G-E-N-T-H-E-I-M. Bad Mergentheim. Total population today is 20,000. In my day, I had about 10,000. During the summer, they have about 10,000 guests who come from all over Europe.
And could you spell the first town too, please?
Würzburg. W-U with the umlaut. R-Z-B-U-R-G. That's a university town with a population about 45,000 today.
And how long did you live in the town that you were born in?
In Würzburg, I was 5 days in the hospital. In Bad Mergentheim, I lived 11 years.
All right, talk more about that town. You said it was a resort town.
Yes. Bad Mergentheim is in the Taubertal. That is a valley. Tauber is a river, a very famous river. It is a medieval town, as so many towns are in Germany. Initially, it was just a farmer's village, and then it became a very famous health resort. That's the main industry. There is no other industry to speak of. It is in the province of Württemberg. Today, Württemberg. W-R-E-N. B-U-R-G. W-U-R-T-T-E-N-B-U-R-G, Württemberg, and Baden, B-A-D-E-N. That's the province today. It is a very picturesque, tranquil town. It is surrounded by low hills, wooded low hills. It has a river, the Tauber, T-A-U-B-E-R, which is a tributary of the Main River, M-A-I-N, which flows into the Rhine. In English, R-H-I-N-E.
Mm-hmm. You said the town is very picturesque?
Yes, very picturesque. In fact, I have pictures of it. We had, in my day, a population of 10,000, and there were 60 Jewish families, all Orthodox. Most of them were merchants, of one kind or another. It was a very close-knit family type of affair. My family was the wealthiest, the richest family. I was literally born with a silver spoon in my mouth. We were the Rockefellers of southern Germany at that time. As a matter of fact, if I can transgress many, many years later here in New York, as an adult I visited. I did not live as an adult in New York initially. I lived in St. Louis, Missouri. We'll get to that later. And I visited Washington Heights, where so many German Jews still are living to this day. They pulled out the red carpet, not because of me, but because of the reputation of my family.
Why were you so wealthy in Germany?
We had a large meatpacking plant, and in Germany it was allowed in those days to have a cartel. We had not only a meatpacking plant, the packing house was leased for 99 years, but we also had a cattle business of livestock, of buying and selling livestock. We were the biggest in Germany, let's say between 1925 and 35.
What's the name of the company?
David Froelich and Sons. David Froelich was my grandfather, after whom I'm named, my father being the oldest. It was called Max Froelich and Son, one son, although there were five others. They were employed. My father was part owner.
Talk about your father. What was his name?
My father is still living, 97 years old, lives in Israel today. My father was the oldest of 12 children, and at the age of 14, he was asked to join the business. He didn't get any salary, or he didn't earn anything. Whatever he needed, he got. He became part owner upon his marriage to my mother in 1927. At that point, my grandfather was no longer alive. When my grandfather died in 25, the business was owned by my grandmother. And then my father became part owner when he married, and his brother Jacob became part owner when he married. The other boys never became owners. They were salaried.
What was your father like as a person?
My father was a very typical German, very, very strong-willed, a very dominant personality, short in stature, built like a football player, a fullback. He had a heart of gold, still has, willing to give you the shirt over his back, but a very impulsive man. Because he served in the German army in the First World War, and because he was from a very small town and rigidly trained, he was a very rigid man and very set, and the typical Prussian type of domineering personality. My father and I, our relationship has gone 365 degrees. I worshiped the ground my father walked on until I became a teenager in America. And then we had differences of opinion, and we became estranged, and there was a long stretch of time where we didn't have good relations. But as he got older and mellowed, and as I got older, and we're now the best of friends and have a very close understanding. And he has a great respect for me, and I have for him.
Let's talk about your mother. What was her name?
My mother's first name is Kate. She's also still living, although today she's in very bad physical condition. She suffers from Alzheimer's, and she's in a wheelchair because she broke her hip and lost the ability to walk.
What was her maiden name?
Schwarzenberger. Oh boy. S-C-H W-A T-Z E-N-B-E-R-G, E-R.
And was she from this town?
No, she came from Bavaria. She came from a city which was very well known as a result of the Second World War, Schweinfurt. That's the home of the Balbering plants, which was bombed to smithereens. I revisited Schweinfurt for the first time in 1988, after having not been there for 50 years. And the downtown area, some of it is still the way it was, but much of it has been destroyed and rebuilt.
How did your parents meet?
They weren't youngsters. They married late in life. My father was 32, my mother was 27. It was arranged by, we say in Hebrew, shidduch. That's spelled S-C-H-I-D-D. UCH, it's an arrangement, a marriage broker type of thing, although there was no money transacted. It was through contacts, you know, this friend has this friend and so on. My father came from a very well-to-do family, very established family, very highly sought after family. My mother's family was also well thought of, but they weren't as financially as well off. It was considered a good match in economic terms. It was very customary and very common in those days. Since my mother was 27 and still single, my father was certainly a very eligible bachelor. It was an arrangement that was made.
What was she like as a person?
She was a very, first of all, my father was a very handsome man. My mother was, I would say, attractive as a young woman from pictures I've seen. She was very docile, although she was a very strong-willed person in her own way, very God-fearing.
What did she look like?
What did she look like? She was of average height. I'd say about 5'1", 5'2". Dark-complected. My father was also dark-complected.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
I have two younger sisters. I was the only child for 7 years. I surmise that my mother must have had a miscarriage. I can't prove it one way or the other. These are delicate subjects that in those days you don't talk about. It's not like today. Even today, I could not approach my mother and father and talk about these areas. However, I recall distinctly when I was about 4 years old, Germany was filled with foolish superstitions, the idea of a stork bringing babies and so on. I was told to put sugar on the ledge that the stork was going to bring me a brother or a sister, and I was asked whether I want either or, and I said, I want a brother. And suddenly this stopped. As an adult, I pieced two things together, that there was an attempt, and my mother miscarried or whatever. And 7 years later, I had a baby sister. Her name was Leah, is Leah. She lives in Israel today. She's the grandmother of many children. She had 13 children of her own, which is not unusual because both my sisters are much more religious than I am.
And what was your other sister's name?
Ruth. She came 2 years later, and she's 9 years younger. And she has 8 children and many grandchildren.
Talk about the house that you grew up in. Can you describe it for me?
Well, you see, the situation was where we were living in a rented fancy home on the edge of town for many years, and I was the only child. I was the boss's son. My father had about 50 or 60 employed people in the slaughterhouse. I was already become acquainted with the business. I was being trained to follow in my father's footsteps, but there was no question in my mind that I was going to be the boss of the business until Hitler came along. And of course, that changed everything.
Can you describe the house that you grew up in?
Vaguely. I can describe my grandmother's house, the family house, the ancestral home.
Did you spend more time there?
I spent more time there, yeah.
Well, talk about that then. Maybe you should start off by talking a little bit about your grandmother.
I didn't like her. I didn't like either one of my grandmothers. My grandfather was the one I thought very highly of, my mother's father.
Why didn't you like your grandmother?
I just didn't know how to handle children. They were very limited in their understanding of how to deal with little children. I mean, I say this now as an adult. In those days, they were not very kind to me, like my grandfather was. He had a way with children. He was psychologically attuned to young kids. My grandmothers, both of them weren't. My grandmother, Bertha, my father's mother, was living in the ancestral home. She was a diabetic. I remember that. She favored the other grandchildren over me, and I resented that. The others didn't live in the same town. I was the only one who lived in town. The others came for visitations from other parts of Germany.
Was this a big house?
It was a big house, yeah. It was 3 stories. It's a typical medieval house. It still stands, although it has been renovated recently. The family homestead had in back of it a shed and a stable, and they built a huge office in 1935. My father was against it because Hitler was already in power and the business was going downhill, but my uncles insisted. My father used to joke, we used to have a big business and a small office, and now we have a small business and a big office. The business began to dwindle in 34. Hitler came to power in 33. Only because we were the Frohlichs, which meant something. There was a time where the name Frohlich meant more than our religion. And then at a certain turning point, the name meant less, and the fact that we were Jews, it was a common denominator, meant more. My father was the only one whose license to operate was renewed in 35 and 36. But in 37, it was not renewed. And at that point, the business was forcibly taken away. It was sold for about 1/10 of its real value to a designated new owner who was a member of the Nazi Party and a former employee of my father's. They held on to the business until it went down the drain. The business no longer exists today altogether. But from 37 until about 80, the business was in the hands of these other people.
Let's talk about your religious life, since this is probably a good time to bring this up.
Well, I was born in an Orthodox family. We were not fanatically Orthodox. We were traditional Orthodox.
You said there were only 60 Jewish families in
right.
this town.
Right. Now, it's interesting to note, historically, German Jews are not known for their Orthodoxy. On the contrast, most German Jews were Reformed, because after 1815 and the division of Europe under Metternich, when Napoleon was defeated. As a matter of fact, I want to change course here. My family, I can trace to 1815. They fled with Napoleon. When he fled Russia, many Jews fled with him and went westward. These Jews, in large number, stopped along the way in Germany, in southern Germany, in the small towns, including my own family. Those who stopped in the large cities wound up Reformed. Most cities, except Frankfurt, which retained its Orthodoxy in the Jewish community, and that's due to one particular rabbi, Samson Raphael Hirsch, who was a very noted Orthodox German rabbi of that particular period. But my family were of peasant stock. They were uneducated, poor. They remained that way. They were not living in Disbot Mercantheim initially. They lived in another community not far away, where my great-great-grandfather settled down.
Was there a synagogue in the town where you were?
Yes. Now? And that synagogue has an interesting history. It was built in 15-something. I'm not sure the exact year. They found only recently the grave of the founder. His name was Baron, a baron in English, who became a free Jew at a time when Jews were not freed by the local baron. That's probably why he took the name Baron. And he donated all of his wealth that he gained from being the moneylender of this duke who lived there. Now, the town is an ancient dukedom that initially belonged to some higher order in Prussia. And we have a castle that still exists to this day in this town, and part of a wall. It was a walled city at one point. And
as a child, do you remember attending services in the synagogue?
Oh, yeah, certainly. Not only did I attend services.
Can you describe the inside of it for me, please?
It was a very beautiful synagogue. It was not burned to the ground, like most synagogues at the first pogrom in November of 38. It was destroyed, but only the inside. They wanted to burn it down, but the neighbors were afraid that if they burned it down, their property would burn down with it. It was surrounded by, to the rear, a monastery. On the left, a farmer, and on the right, a farmer. And in those days, you didn't have spaces in between. It was all built together. So they destroyed it. It was a horrible sight. I came the day after the Kristallnacht pogrom was over, and together with my buddies, we had to clean up the mess.
How old were you?
10. Now I vividly remember it.
Talk about it.
Well, first of all, if you want to talk about Kristallnacht, I was...
to your history.
Okay.
Describe your participation.
I'm talking about my own home. My father had already decided to go to America at that point, and he did not have a trade, and he recognized that in order to earn a living, he had to have a trade. So he went for the butchery trade. He had signed up for a butcher course in Munich, but he never was able to get to Munich. He got sick a few days before Kristallnacht, and he was laid up with a severe case of strep throat and fever. The Jewish doctor was already in Dachau, the concentration camp. So the doctor who attended my father was a Gentile and a member of the Nazi party. On the eve of Kristallnacht, we knew nothing. Although all the other people were attacked and beaten up, because we were who we were, my father was spared. So we knew nothing until the next morning when the neighbor came hysterically to our door telling us that there was this pogrom, that Jews are being rounded up from males, age 14 and over, and being arrested, presumably be taken away to a concentration camp, that they're trying to burn down the school, which together with the synagogue. I was already in the fourth grade at that point, fifth grade. I started school in 1935, and in 35 we have the infamous Nuremberg Laws. These Nuremberg Laws, among other things, prohibited Jewish children from attending public school. So I only attended a Jewish school. The Jewish school was in the complex where the synagogue was. It was like in the courtyard. There was a synagogue, and then the school, and then the residency of the teacher. Now, I was at home in the morning, looked out the window. We lived no longer in the fancy suburban areas. We were denied that. We lived in a rented home over a shoe store in the town square. And I knew something was unusual. And then the neighbor came and told us what was happening, and I became petrified. And I pleaded with my parents, I don't want to go to school. They said, okay, you can stay home. My father, who was sick in bed, said to my mother, why don't you go and check on my mother and see that she's all right, because she was all alone. She lived catty corner across from the synagogue in the what is called the Judengasse, which is a Jewish street. It's a little alley, medieval alley, like so many. J-U-D-E-N, that's Juden, and Gasse, which is alley, G-A-S-S-E. My mother asked the neighbor to babysit for my sisters and myself, and she agreed. In the meantime, a policeman came to our door, and I became hysterical. I knew why he came. And I ran to the kitchen, and I began to cry and pray. And he was wearing the typical police uniform and the boots, which had cleats, so they made a lot of noise. And he said, Heil Hitler. I said, you want to see my father? The neighbor, he thought the neighbor was my mother. She said, she's just a babysitter. He asked for my dad. He was told he's sick in bed. He says, I want to see him. And that's when I began to pray. I heard boots. I heard a pair of boots. And I didn't hear 4 feet. I heard 2 feet. And the neighbor came and touched me on the shoulder and said, you can relax. They didn't take your daddy. What had happened was, and this, of course, I didn't know until much later, is that he went to my father's bedside. He asked what's the matter with him. My father told him. He looked at the medicine. And he saw the name of the doctor, that he recognized that he was a Gentile, he was a member of the Nazi Party. He was a decent Joe. He was about 24, 25 years old, and he left my father alone. Now comes another part of the story. When the policeman came empty-handed to the police station, he got chewed out by the SS, the Gauleiter. He is the head of the Nazi Party. And he... SS officer called the doctor to verify. And the doctor went out on a limb and he said as follows. This I got from the doctor's son when I met him sometime 83, I believe, I met him at a reunion of Holocaust survivors. Both the doctor and his son are dead today. But he says, my father told me this story, that he was called by the SS officer and he said to him, this man is my patient. He is ill. Don't you dare touch him. If you do, I will call up Himmler myself. Everybody knew Himmler was the head of the SS nationally. And that frightened the officer away. Now, he was bluffing. He pretended that he was a personal friend of Himmler. He did this to save my father, and he did. I am convinced, knowing my father, while he was physically a very tough cookie, even down to his old age, even to this day, I might say, he has tremendous physical stamina. But psychologically, he would not have survived Dachau because he was not that kind of a person. So this doctor definitely saved my father.
Did your father get better soon?
My father recovered within a few days, and he was the only man in our town who was not arrested. It scared the living daylights out of my father, and
Is this when he decided to come to America?
Right.
Talk about that, please.
He went to Stuttgart to the American consulate and asked for it. We had to have a quota number. It was a quota system. We got a number, and things began to go from bad to worse. Shortly thereafter, he lost all rights to operate. He was alone in business by this time.
What year is this?
We're talking about 38. I might also digress here a little bit about another incident. The person who is still one of my closest friends today was my first teacher, the teacher in Germany, who now lives in Chicago. He's retired. David Zucker is his name. David befriended me from the first day I entered school. I became somewhat of a teacher's pet. There was a certain chemistry between us from the very beginning. He shielded me from a lot of rough stuff. He shielded all of us, but me in particular. He understood I was a very sensitive, a very delicate type of person. I favor my mother when it comes to psych and physical condition as well. While I have many traits of my father, basically I'm a type of person who will swallow things and eat things inside. That's why today I have psoriasis and many other problems. Anyway, he was of Polish descent. He was born in Germany. Now, Hitler took all the Poles one day, about 30 days before Kristallnacht, and dumped them into Poland, including my teacher. David came back to Germany because he recognized, he got permission from the Polish government to get his belongings because they left without so much as a toothbrush. He felt he could do his mother no good. His mother was still alive. His father was a victim of casualty of World War I. He couldn't do his mother any good in Poland. He was fearful that if he stayed in Poland, he would be drafted in the Polish army, and he didn't want that. So he went to Germany, and he recognized that in Germany he would become stateless. And that's what happened to him. I'll talk about David later. David is one of the people that played a major role in my development, together with my father and my grandfather and a few people later on in my life. As far as Kristallnacht was concerned, it was one of the worst experiences I've had. I had one other that was about a year later, just before we left. I want to talk about it. I got beaten up routinely from 35 on. There was one particular person in our town who was the bully of the Hitler Youth. Children can be very cruel, sometimes more so than adults. And the Hitler Youth, which were my peers and those who were a little bit older than me, were merciless. And they used to corner us and spit at us and taunt us and give us a licking. But it was all superficial, nothing really drastic. Until I happened to be the one who was exposed to the first real drastic incident. The incident started out innocently enough. It was about a month before we left, so it must have been in September of 39. My father and my mother were taking English lessons. They told me to take this English textbook back to the teacher, who lived only a block away from us. I walked outside, across the churchyard. We lived across the street from the Catholic church. Outside, when this town bully spotted me, and he never walked alone. He always wore with his uniform. He always had a dagger with him. He was 14 years of age. I was then 11. He spotted me, and he cornered me into the churchyard, and he threw me against the outer wall of the church. And first, the traditional thing was they spit in my face. They said, sing a Jewish song. I did, as I was told, because I was petrified. A crowd gathered, mostly kids, boys and girls, teenagers, preteens, and also adults, but they were further back. When he saw the book, he was ignorant of the fact that it was English. He only realized it wasn't German. He thought it was Hebrew. He said, read it. I said, I can't. He says, read it or I'll kill you. In the meantime, he's being taunted by the kids. kill him, kill him, kill him. So he says, read it. I said, I can't. So he took his dagger, and this is something they never did before. But as we move along in date, this is typical of Holocaust. Holocaust was not a revolutionary thing. It was a very gradual strangulation of Jewish life. It was an evolutionary process. Each day and each month and each year, it got a little bit worse. And there was no physical danger to adult Jews in Germany in 1938 until the pogrom of Kristallnacht. There was, did somebody knock on the door?
Okay. So what did he do with the dagger?
He took the dagger and cut me across. He cut me here, and I saw blood, and I knew he meant business. I got petrified. And the kids kept screaming, kill him, kill him, kill him. He said, he saw that I couldn't do it. He says, say your father's a bastard. I refused. And he took his thumbs and began to choke me. And he meant business. And I knew he meant business. And I didn't do this consciously. I didn't do it deliberately. It all happened fast that I can talk about it. But I stopped breathing. And obviously, when you stop breathing, you faint. And I fainted. And I was wearing the Tiroler pants, the leather pants like in Bavaria, and my knees were exposed, and I fell. It was a dirt area and with stones and so on. I lacerated my knee, and I began to bleed. They also cut me here, because I have a scar here. Now, when this happened, I don't remember. But anyway, there was a policeman just before they cut me. I started screaming, help me, help me, help me, and he turned around and went the other way. Now, what happened to me in comparison, what happened to others later, long after I left, is child's play, is a Sunday school picnic. The man who was responsible for this is still alive. I don't know where, I don't know, I don't want to know. I wouldn't want to face him. I don't know what I would do. I have been told that he became a lawyer, and that he's an honorable and an honored citizen in another community. I presume Stuttgart, but this is a guess on my part, because many of the people who survived World War II moved. Most of the people who live in our town, in this town now, are not native-born.
Let's get you to America.
Okay. We got out of Germany legally. We entered Holland illegally.
Did this take a long time for you
yes.
to get papers?
Well, we went to Stuttgart 5 days after the outbreak of World War II. We got our papers. My father had passage on a German liner that was canceled. We were stuck in Germany. Now there was a new requirement. You have to have an exit visa, a special permit from the local authority.
This is for the five of you now.
Yeah.
Ma, Dad, you, and two sisters.
That's right. We had packed a lift with our belongings, and that was in port in Bremerhaven.
Do you remember what you took?
Yeah, we packed 5 rooms, complete furnishings. Some of my prized possessions, which included a rocking horse, a stamp collection, part of a stamp collection, because part of it I took with me personally.
And the intention was to take all this furniture and everything to America.
America, right. But we were advised not to take it out of Germany until we get on the boat and put it on that boat. Well, when we couldn't do that, it was sent to Rotterdam, presumably that we would get to, okay. My father did a foolish thing, and the day we left, first of all, we left, I said we have German papers, passport. We got the document, the exit permit, which was limited for 3 days. The end would be October 1st, 1939, not to be renewed, not renewable. I knew the kids in town, my father didn't. We were not allowed to take anything but one small suitcase. My father went to a friend of his, who was a butcher, and says, do me a favor, drive us to the nearest big town, Würzburg again, where there's an express stop for a train. We want to go to Cologne, where I have a sister. And then from Cologne, we were supposed to go to Holland. My father had faked papers to get into Holland. We had faked a passage on a Dutch liner, which had already left. My father was in touch with a cousin in Amsterdam, who was in touch with the HIAS, which is a service organization that would help immigrants. Anyway, he told his kid, take the suitcases, your boss is going to take us. Well, the kid went to the boss and says, if you take this Jew, I'm going to report you to the Gestapo. The guy was afraid to do it to begin with, so we had to go to the edge of town. This was during wartime. It was complete blackout. We said goodbye to my grandmother and my aunt, my youngest aunt. She's still living today in Israel. And we waited and waited and waited. And this same kid came by sneaking out and says, I'm sorry, but Mr. Market can't take you. Something came up. And when my father realized that I was right, we had to go back into the town. We went to the local railroad station. We took a local train. We went to Würzburg. My father says, I don't want to go to the waiting room. The train we want to take was already gone. We had to take another train. Let's walk out. My father used to travel a great deal by train all over Germany, and he knew all about trains. Let's go to the track. I know where the train is waiting. The train emanated from Würzburg and was going as far as Cologne. So we were going from end to end. That's a trip of about 8 hours. It was 4 o'clock in the morning. We went out into the out to the track, to the train. There was a German officer, not a Nazi, but a soldier. And he vacated, the German trains to this day are not like American trains. It's not just one big coach, but they're compartments, like all European trains. And we went into a compartment. It was empty. We left at 6 o'clock. We went towards Frankfurt. We got into Frankfurt. More and more people came on. It got to be crowded by the time we got into the Rhineland. People realized that we were Jews. I mean, who would travel in those days? Most of the people on the train were military personnel. It was during the wartime. And they began to taunt us and curse us and spit at us. We had a stand. It was miserable. We finally got to Cologne. It was a holiday, Jewish holiday. And we took a taxi. Now, a taxi in those days was a horse and carriage. And went to my uncle's and aunt's house. They weren't home yet. They were still in synagogue. So we waited outside. They came shortly. We spent the weekend with them. Now comes the first of hair-raising experience. Since we had this permit, which was expiring on Sunday, this was Sunday morning, October 1st, they set an alarm clock Saturday night so they would be sure to get up on time. There was one train leaving per day for the Dutch border, and that train was at 9 o'clock. We were supposed to get up at 6. We were an hour's travel away from the station. We overslept. My mother was hysterical. We will never get out. The permit can't be renewed. My father is a realist, and he felt very bad. My uncle was a very pious person, says, if it's God's will, we say in Hebrew or in Yiddish, beshared, you'll get out. I'll call the station master, maybe there's a second train. My father says, nonsense, there is no second train. What's the point? My father has always been a realist. At any rate, my uncle called, and for some strange reason, I don't know to this day why, there was a second train, just an exception, at 2 p.m. Well, we ran like hell to the station, and we got on this train, and we rolled along. We went to the Dutch border. There were a lot of people, but they got off one by one, mostly military, until we got to the last town, and that I'll spell for you too, Kleve, K-L-E-V-E. Which was the border. There was nobody on the train but my family and one single man. We were in the first coach. He was in the rear. My father says, I want to get into the station because we're not allowed to take any currency out whatsoever. I'll wire all my money back to my sister. My father goes into the station, and I see three men coming out of the station, one in civilian clothes, one in a policeman's uniform, and one in the black SS uniform. He has a pistol. And within minutes, he takes the solo man off the train at gunpoint. My mother sees it, and she gets very upset. What are they going to do to Daddy? And we had a coal engine to the border. But the Dutch were a little more advanced. They had already electricity, electrical engine or diesel engine. In those days, to change engines, you have to take the whole train out, put it on a turntable, and put on the other caboose. We didn't know that. Anyway, the train begins to move. And my mother is worried about my father. They're going to arrest father, or they arrested father. We were out there a few minutes, and we moved back into the station. we had the other engine. The three men come back. They come to my mother, Heil Hitler, your passport. And we had up in the suitcase, my parents secretly smuggled out their wedding bands that were supposed to surrender all silver and gold after Kristallnacht. And they had put those in a jar of cold cream. And I had part of my stamp collection, which was forbidden. And I hid that somewhere in a suitcase. Because they made us crazy in Cologne. The Jews were suffering a great deal more in the large cities than in the small towns. I had two pair of underwear and three pair of socks, what have you. This man, the Nazi who spoke, he says, may I see your passport? He looked at the passport. He says, why do you want to leave Germany? He addressed my mother. And she says, well, you see our passport. I have the original passport with me still in Israel. A great big red J. She says, you see why we're leaving. So he laughed, sort of sarcastically. That's a good idea. My mother says, you want to look at our luggage? He says, that's not necessary. He was correct. He wasn't friendly, but he was correct. And he left us alone. And he wished us Godspeed. And he walked off. And my mother says, I know why he was so nice. They arrested father as a hostage. And the train starts pulling out again. No daddy. The train moves out, you know, very, very slowly, 5 kilometers an hour. And I see out of the corner of my eye as we move out of the station, my father walks out of the station like nothing happened. He doesn't know from anything. He sees the train in motion and he runs after it. He jumps on. He comes to us. He looks at my mother. She's white as a sheet. Kate, what happened? She opens her mouth. Nothing happens. I'm the oldest. He comes to me. David, what happened? I open my mouth, but I can't talk. We move 2 seconds, we stop. We were at the physical border. On the German side, one soldier with a rifle, that's all. We go around the little hill, 45 degree angle. We're now inside Holland. Hundreds of tanks, soldiers, all in black uniform. A Dutch security officer comes on, he comes to us. He looks at our German passport. He says, Dag, which is Dutch for hello. He looks at our faces. He realizes we don't speak any Dutch. He said something in Dutch. We didn't understand it. He switches over to German. And he said in German to my father and mother, you can relax now. You're free. Sie können sich beruhigen. Sie sind jetzt frei in German. Well, when that registered, we all began to bawl because the realization had sunken in. We've made it. We're out of it. We're free. Now the next hurdle comes. We get into Nijmegen, which is the end of the line.
Can you spell it, please?
That's Dutch. I'm going to spell it the German way. I can't spell the Dutch way. N-I-N-W-E-I-G-E-N. I think we have to stop now.
Just pause for a moment.